Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 272 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature writer Richard Klein. Richard has written for many periodicals, including The Atlantic Magazine. He has recently released a new novel, a bit of fiction, titled Petroleum Transfer Engineer. We talk about writing, we talk about his book, we talk about politics, about Noam Chomsky and Neruda a bit as well. Great conversation with writer Richard Klein today on the program. We have an EW essay by yours truly, titled Hullabaloo, and another beautifully crafted and wonderfully read original essay by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, titled Glad Rags, and a poem, too, called Gladys. All of this, of course, will be infused with the energy of several great tunes. Let's get to it. Episode 272 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Hullabaloo. I sit back somewhat somber, somewhat at peace on my couch, listening to the breeze and the electric weed whackers spinning their fishing line, cutting down unassuming dandelion and such, as mine continue to grow. It is spring. I still have autumn leaves lying about. The grass is growing through, over, and all around those scattered leaves. They are detritus now. Payments for the mortgage, utilities, a new computer, college apartment. Maybe I'll limit my visits to the grocery store this week again. I'd like to ask the beautiful swan I've been with for a while something important and special, but I don't know how to afford the jeweled ritual that is tantamount to the cultural expectation of commitment and love in this town. Though the ritual doesn't speak that way to me, it does significantly to family, friends, neighbors, peers, and larger society. What is a man, this man, to do? All the hullabaloo as I sit back on this couch, as I listen, breathe, ponder, watch. Well, maybe it's time for a good meal and a beer. I will figure it all out, this bandying about, no doubt. The birds are chip-chirping away at the day, as the depths of my existence are as malleable, steadfast, and eternal as balls of smooth, vital, bronze-brown, red clay.
Smoked his stogies in bed, but I'm all right, I'm all right. I've been lonely before. I asked the boy for a few kind words. He gave me a novel instead, but I'm all right, I'm all right. I've been lonely before. It's okay, it was wrong, either way. I just wanted to say that it isn't much fun when you're drinking for one. He got drunk, he fell down, he threw a few of my things around. But I'm alright, I'm alright. Songs in bed.
Hello?
Richard Klin, is that you?
It's me. Hello, Mr. Conundrum.
It's a pleasure to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tour, sir.
It's a pleasure for me to be here.
And before we get started, let me give the folks some background information, if you don't mind.
No, absolutely.
Richard Klin is a writer. His fiction has appeared in Flyover Country Review, Akashic Books, Thursdays series, Writing Light Review, Jewish Currents, Box of Jars, Chronogram, The Copperfield Review, Adelaide, Poetica, Kindling Quarterly, and The Strange Recital Podcast. His essays have appeared in The Atlantic, The Forward, The Rambler, 1966, a journal of creative nonfiction, Jewish Currents, Counterpunch, among others. Richard's reviews have appeared in The Forward, Brooklyn Rail, Gastronomica, January. His music writing has appeared in The Brooklyn Rail, Blue Coupe, Counterpunch, among others. He has written profiles of the great Noam Chomsky, Russell Banks, Hugh Nesensen, and poet David Shapiro. Richard has done feature writing for Hudson Valley Magazine and articles for Humor Times. And he has a new novel just published in March by Underground Voices out of L.A. titled Petroleum Transfer Engineer. It is our pleasure to have Richard Klin on Troubadours and Rock on Tours this go around. Welcome, sir.
Well, it's a very big pleasure for me to be included, and thank you for doing all this research on me, too. It sounds very impressive.
It does.
Hope you haven't done too much research, you know, but I have no skeletons in my closet, though, not really.
No, we'll bring up the skeletons later on, you know. You know, we'll set you up and then hit you with that curveball, you know, and get you all shaken. And, you know, that's good radio, right? Demoralize the guest and then get high ratings.
I'm set for it, too. It's fine.
No, just kidding.
I know.
All right, let's get right into your book, why don't we? Because that's, I mean, March. It's a new publication.
Go ahead.
Petroleum Transfer Engineer is the title. Give us a little, you know, I guess, background on it. Maybe what spurred you to create this story and such?
I think, well, you know, it is not, it's personal, not autobiographical, but I did grow up in South Jersey. I did have a job at a gas station, even though I have to insist, you know, it's a fictional creation. It's not my life. I think I wanted to show this very small sub-region that no longer exists. I think when people think of New Jersey, if they do think of New Jersey, there's an element of urban sprawl. And South Jersey really was a real tucked away little corner, almost as if the South or the Midwest had been grafted onto the East Coast, and it's gone. You know, it sort of has disappeared metaphorically and disappeared literally. And I just wanted to tell a story. It's sort of as simple as that in a way. I wanted to capture a mood and a place, and you know, there's a plot, obviously, but I think I wanted to display this little region that no longer exists.
Why do you say it no longer exists, Richard?
I think a lot of, you know, the past obliterates quite a lot of things. Part of what happened in South Jersey is what happened nationally. I think that regional quirks have disappeared. You know, in this didn't make it into my book, but we were in the Philadelphia, South Jersey, in the Philadelphia media orbit. There was a horror show called Dr. Shock, where this guy dressed as a vampire would come out of his coffin. Every city had that. I've spoken to friends from Ohio. There was the Dr. Shock equivalent. You know, all that stuff is gone. That sort of a national occurrence, for whatever reason, some of these quirky regionalisms have disappeared. You know, in South Jersey, it really did happen. I think the casinos and development and time passing have really erased the localisms. You know, it was farmland to a large extent, South Jersey. That's gone. You know, I the sort of quirkiness is gone. The developments have sort of taken over. Again, it's sort of a national phenomenon. You know, there's a big, I guess it's Pier 1 or Pier 9, some pier somewhere. I remember it as a duck farm, you know, way back when. So I think that there's that aspect I was trying to convey, that you know, the past is a foreign country. There's the metaphoric disappearance and the literal disappearance. You know, the old lumber yard is gone. The duck farm is gone. You know, so I think I wanted to show that you can't really see, you can't see that South Jersey anymore quite literally. It sort of looks like every place else to an extent. So
yeah, that is a shame, you know. Mm-hmm. When you can go, I mean, some people, I suppose, myself included, feel it's a comforting thing when you travel around and everything looks familiar, because that way, I guess, you never get out of your comfort zone. But
yeah,
in a way, that's a negative, I think, in the larger scheme of things, when you don't have this quirky sort of individual uniqueness from one place to the next across the continent.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it hasn't vanished completely, obviously, you know, but I think there has been sort of an ironing out of quirky regionalisms and just simply local slang. All the sort of the detritus of just day-to-day life has really been ironed out in a lot of ways. And, you know, South Jersey for real, and South Jersey in my novel, you know, again, this is not a journalistic recreation, you know, I've taken lots of liberties. But again, it's gone, you know, the rural aspects, the sort of eccentricities, I don't think that exists so much in this country, you know, and in some ways it's probably wonderful. Everybody can locate Bulgarian music on the web, you know, I mean, there's something you would have been unimaginable decades ago, but you sort of lost something in a way. And again, you know, I also, it's not a total nostalgia trip. You know, the characters, some of the characters in my novel are bigoted. You know, it's not just simply a mourning of a wonderful time past. You know, it's a very mixed bag, the way this country is a mixed bag. So in some ways, you know, certain things you're not going to mourn, you know, so in that respect, it's a little complicated, I think, you know.
What's the time period? Is it the late 20th century, or?
Loosely 1983, very loosely. I wanted to show a region really disappearing. The casinos were coming in, and that was the real beginning, I think, of the end of that little sub-region. And I wanted to show that. It's a real time of transition. Like the character, the protagonist, Francis, finds himself working at this sprawling gas station off the Atlantic City Expressway, notices limousines are starting to arrive. I think he goes to try to find this old lumberyard that's disappeared. So the bits and pieces of the end are starting to appear. And I thought 1983, loosely 83, is sort of a good center point in a way, that he, Francis, is sort of adrift, like his landscape is adrift. I sort of had it as symbiotic in a way, that he is sort of in a period of strange transition, and the region, South Jersey, is in a period of strange transition. So I thought that was a good delineating point, 1983.
And where were you in your life in 1983 in terms of your development? How old were you?
I was, you know, Francis is sort of roughly my same age. I graduated from college in 1983. The big, huge difference is the real gas station was strictly a summer job for me. And at some point in my life, there was a kind of angst-ridden, drifting 20s experience, you know, where you sort of question everything, don't know what's going to happen to you. I sort of lashed that together with someone working at a gas station, you know, like in real life, it was strictly a summer job. I sort of twinned that kind of existential angst. What am I doing with myself? That I like to think everybody goes through, but maybe it was just me. So that, you know, that's where it really deviates from my own life. I went to New York a couple years later. You know, it's all the stuff that Francis, the protagonist, wouldn't or couldn't do, I think.
And I guess the phrase, the term petroleum transfer engineer is the position at the gas station.
It's a position at the gas station. It's sort of, it feels like something Francis, who has short-circuited his academic career and sort of made a mess of his life and finds himself working at this gas station, it's something he would say. The words never appear actually in the novel, but it feels like a kind of quasi-funny sort of academic thing that he would do in a way. He would refer to himself as a gas station attendant, as a petroleum transfer engineer. It feels sort of funny, and it feels sort of forced, which I sort of felt was indicative of the protagonist, I think.
You know, I haven't read the novel yet. I hope to. But just based on what I've read and what you're explaining to me, what keeps popping into my head is something similar, and you're your own writer, but in your own voice, but similar to maybe a Thomas Pynchon.
Wow. I don't think it's I'm nearly as abstract as Pynchon, but I welcome the comparison. That's really wonderful. You know, thank you. I think that Pynchon is sort of more dystopian, more obscure. This is a little on a more human scale in a way. Like, it's not, the motivations aren't that odd somehow, you know, but I'll take the comparison. I'm very happy compared to Pynchon, you know.
Oh, no. I look forward to reading it. You have me compelled.
Well, thanks.
And the intersection of art and politics, it seems like there is one here, in a way. You're talking about a lot of social issues, which, of course, should be addressed by politics. And art, from my perspective, is one of the best ways we as a society can look at our challenges and our, you know, our state of affairs. What do you think about that?
I totally agree. And I think it's a strange sort of American tick, almost, the idea that art and politics don't mix. I mean, I think that it's sort of axiomatic in the rest of the world that you will be producing art that is entwined with politics. And it doesn't mean that it's an overt political screed. You know, there is, I think there are oblique politics in this book, in my novel. There's the whole world of work that is sort of complete nonsense in a way. Francis returns home and finds his sister has become this sort of go-getting person doing ad copy for a local radio station. And just the minutiae and the sort of gravitas of nothing. Like, at some point, the radio station's tagline is the Rockin' Wave. And there's sort of a debate, should they put an apostrophe at the end of Rockin' or have it as Rocking with a G? So there's that, you know. I would like it to be political. I don't know if you could construe that as completely political, but there is a sort of absurdity of the work world in a way. The go-getting ad people, the very fact that Francis is somehow finding himself pumping gas. So, and there is a sort of marginalized community. You know, a lot of the people working at the gas station are sort of castaways, poor, uneducated, ex-Marines, Vietnam vets. So, that aspect is social commentary. And I think, you know, I certainly would like to do more along those lines. But I do think that art and politics are far from mutually exclusive. And I really do think it's probably a matter for a whole other broadcast. But there's something oddly American about that aversion to non-political art. When I think in a lot of other parts of the world, most parts of the world, it's just accepted, you know. I don't think a Middle Eastern writer or a Central American writer would think for a second, is there a distinction between my art and political statements?
Right, right. You think about a Neruda, right? Or you think, you know, Salman Rushdie. This is some of the guys that come pop into my Marquez. So many of those great writers, always there was a political tinge, a political element to what they wrote, what they delved into.
Yeah, and I don't think it's you know, it doesn't have to be mandatory either. You know, I think that art for art's sake, beauty for the sake of beauty, is perfectly wonderful. You know, I don't see it as something you have to do, but it's definitely there. And again, you're right. People like Neruda, I think it would be a complete mystery why you'd even have this discussion. Are art and politics compatible? You know, it's like saying, does the sun rise in the morning? You know. Israeli writers deal full force with political issues, you know, Central American writers. So there's an odd, like, American idea, I think, that art and politics are completely incompatible. And it's just not true, you know.
It's almost like you get punished if you go there sometimes. Like, oh, we'd accept you. We'd support your work with our economic, you know, backing. But once you start getting political, now you've crossed a line and we don't want to hear that.
I think so, too. And there's also sort of the critical disdain, you know, that political art equals sort of a dull political screed, that it can't be artful, that either you're sort of shouting slogans or singing sort of exaggerated protest songs, or you're creating non-political beautiful art. It's just a strange, it's a dichotomy that doesn't really exist in the real world, I think. And I find it sort of especially problematic when this country is, you know, my God, the whole political system here, you know, how could you not comment on it? You know?
Right, right, exactly.
To say the least, you know. And I think there is, you know, there is lots of political art. You know, I think that if you go hunting for it, again, it doesn't have to be a Pete Seeger song, which leaves no doubt, okay, this is a political song, but, you know, think of Dos Passos as USA, you know, just the list goes on and on of stuff that is wonderful writing, artful writing, and very, very political, you know. I think, again, if you go looking for it, I remember being struck at some point when I watched The Godfather, you know, that how much it is, it's the American dream, you know. I mean,
exactly.
They're saying they're climbing up the ladder, they're devoting their lives to business, you know, but it, there's sort of a perverted element to it, you know. So I think that that list goes on and on, you know, and I think that there's this odd shrinking away from that kind of thing where you can't, it's like the third rail, you know, political art means something wretched and not political, or not artful, rather, you know. So I think that, yeah, there's something very American about that.
Well put. Well put. Ladies and gentlemen, again, we're talking to writer Richard Klin, and we're reflecting on several ideas, but in the context right now of his new novel, Petroleum Transfer Engineer. And, you know, you've also done different sorts of writing other than this is a fiction, but somewhat a fictional piece, but somewhat autobiographical, though you've written reviews and profiles. One that popped out to me was a profile you wrote about Noam Chomsky, speaking of politics.
Oh, yeah. That was really a highlight, I have to say. And I had contacted him almost out of the blue, and he, you know, staked out some time for us to see him. My wife, Lily Prince, is a painter and photographer, and we've collaborated a lot. And we found ourselves heading over to Cambridge and interviewing Noam Chomsky. And it was really quite astonishing. You know, I mean, he's someone that I'm not going to say worshipped, but I mean, certainly looked at as a guide for years and years. And then to be in his presence, I sort of had to sublimate those fanboy impulses, you know, like, oh my God, it's Noam Chomsky, you know? And there were certain moments where I was arranging my notes and recording what he was saying, and I would hear his voice, the voice that I've heard over and over again, and realize that that's coming from that man next to me. That's Noam Chomsky. So it was really quite astonishing, you know? I think there was also, quite honestly, this deep down feeling that way, way buried, that maybe he would be so impressed by my questions, he would sort of take me under his wing and have dinner and, you know, sort of develop this relationship, you know, but of course that didn't happen, really. You know? That's really honest, you know, there's that. Some others, we'd have this simpatico vibe and, you know, I'd come for Thanksgiving or whatever. That wasn't the case.
I could totally relate to that.
Yeah, I know. I have to really... That was so buried, you know, I have to be in the interest of honesty, you know. But it was amazing. I mean, he's amazing in general, I think. I mean, he's about 90, and it was a real honor.
And he's a linguist by training, right?
He's a linguist by training, which I find sort of more astonishing. It's almost like the political stuff is almost, it's secondary. You know, he made his name in the linguistics world. I think in the 50s, he sort of took down B.F. Skinner, sort of the reigning god. I know almost nothing about linguistics, by the way. So it's almost like this, the political stuff, which is quite extensive, is extra in a way. So it's a really uncommon dynamic, I think, where he's renowned in linguistics and staked out this enormous political sphere also, too. So I think that's really unique, I think.
Where might we find this profile of Noam Chomsky that you put together?
It's a webzine called January, where I profiled Russell Banks and David Shapiro. I know you'd mentioned that at the beginning. January.com, and it should all be archived, you know. But the Chomsky piece was really quite amazing, you know.
Well, we have probably about 6 or 7 more minutes. I'd like for you to share with us, you know, how you got to this position, to this place where you are a writer. What influenced you? How did this happen?
I think it was always there, but it was sort of too frightening to come to grips with in a way. There's just something about the idea that openly declaring oneself a writer would bring on like a lightning bolt or something. I guess because it is a sort of very... it sort of in some ways is really antithetical to my personality, but what you really are doing is saying, hey, look at me, look at this writing and feel like I'm doing that, but that's what you are. You know, there's sort of an element of, it's not as overt as being a musician and being on stage, but it is sort of akin to that in a way. And just for me, it took a lot of fessing up in a way. I'd worked in book publishing forever. I'd written things in private from the time I was younger. You know, but somehow like putting two and two together and coming out and saying, I'm a writer. It took a long time to do that. And there is, you know, in some ways for good reason, you get a lot of rejections. You know, it's a lot of sitting around and writing and then writing again and then writing again and writing again. You know, there's a lot of real drudgery. It's all the stuff people say that is true, you know.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn.
We live in New York's Hudson Valley. I lived in Brooklyn before, actually. And it was sort of a monastic existence at some level. You know, I would wake up early every morning to write, like every single morning. So it's a hard life in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, I'm not going to do a song and dance about the suffering artist because, you know, it's not the case. But I think there's a lot of fessing up on some level, you know. And I think there's also...
When you say fessing up, you mean fessing up in what way?
I think fessing up in every way. Fessing up and this is what I want to do. Fessing up and this is what's important to me. Like, in other words, the novel, there's nothing... You sort of are laying it all out there, even though, like I said, I have to insist this is not the life story of Richard Klein, you know. But it obviously comes from the heart and from sweat and from effort. And if people hate the novel, I can't pretend it won't affect me. If the novel does badly, I can't pretend it won't affect me. And I think there's something very intimate about writing in a way. You're putting something that you really care about out there for the world to like or disregard or not like. There's something very naked about it on some level, and I think it's hard to fess up in some ways. You can't shrug it off, at least it's my feeling. You know, if a petroleum transfer engineer met with scorn, I couldn't say, oh, you know, I didn't really care that much, because I do care that much. I think there's something just sort of shockingly intimate about writing, even though if it's not strictly autobiographical, like you've created something very special that you've worked hard on and you're sort of putting it out there. I don't find that effortless. I find it just the opposite, you know.
What would be worse, do you think? It just popped into my head. If something you put out there, like this particular novel, was totally overlooked, no one made any mention at all of it, or it was, you know, ravaged by the critics, what would be worse?
You know, that's a really, really good question. It sort of depends why it'd be ravaged by the critics. You know, I think there's that, if there was some kind of outrageous reason people were savaging it, excuse me, like it was so shocking, that'd be sort of wonderful, you know, in a way. If it was savaged because the writing was mediocre, that'd be even more horrible in a way. Right, you know, then having it ignored is also horrible. All those things are horrible for different reasons, you know. Right now, it seems to be sort of tilting toward the no one's paying that much attention to it, quite honestly. You know, I don't see Oprah calling me or anything, you know.
It's hard. There's so much out there. I'm sure there are brilliant novels that we've never, ever heard of.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have to sort of take that element with a grain of salt, you know. But I don't see reviewers falling all over themselves reviewing it, you know. So there's that, you know. But yeah, I think having it, you know, derided by critics must feel pretty horrible too, you know. Probably in a different way. I hope never to experience all that, quite honestly, you know.
Yeah, me too. I was just curious what a writer. I've asked that question a few times, and it's always it's a tough one to answer for certain.
I think there's sort of that both extremes where you sort of hope that there's going to be wild, wild acclaim and fear wild critical derision. But the reality is sort of this middle where no one's deriding it, but no one's exactly flocking to it either in a way, you know.
Even I've read critical reviews of some other guests I've had in the past of works that they put out there. A playwright that we have on regularly, she put out a new 2 years ago, a new production that I read the critical review, and I thought it was decent. I didn't think it was great. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a friend of mine who actually, he's our associate producer, Dr. Pavese. He is a trained reviewer. And he said, no, that was a good review. They're never wonderful, over the top, or rarely are they. Right. And that particular production won the Pulitzer this year. You know, so what, you know, reviews, they're rarely going to be over the top, 100%. You're an amazing, brilliant,
You know. Yeah. I think the ugly fact is no one's thinking about you that hard, you know?
That's, right.
The reviewer is not probably thinking, this is a masterpiece, it's changed my life, you know? You'd like to think that. They probably have millions of other things to review and things to do also. You know, I think that's a sort of gritty reality in a way. You know, there's sort of this dull middle somehow, you know, much as we'd like to think otherwise.
Plus, how good would they be if they told everybody they were amazing, fantastic? That's their job, you know.
Yeah, I know. That's. I mean, there's certain reviewers who are like that. Like I remember Gene Shalit, I guess from the Today Show, who every review was just superlative, and you sort of wonder if they're on the PR payroll somehow. You know,
right?
There's that aspect too. You know.
And you've done some reviewing as well, I presume.
Yeah, right? lots of it. Yeah. And then you try to, you don't want it to sound like a blurb. I think that's exactly, you've hit on something, you know. It would be sort of, it would sound like puffery if one wrote, this is the most amazing thing that I've ever seen or read or whatever. You know, I don't think anybody would believe you, really. You know?
No. Now, before our time runs out, Richard Klin, please share with us maybe some contact info so people could find your work and keep up with what you're doing in the future. And maybe share with us what you do have planned for the future.
You know, sort of what I have planned depends on the gods of publishing. You know, I have another novel sort of on the horizon, and I have a collection of short stories that I just finished also, too. So that what happens to that sort of is beyond my control. I have a website that I've started with my really rudimentary technical skills. It's www.richardklin.com, K-L-I-N. And the book is up on, the publishing company is out of L.A. It's called Underground Voices. The book is on their website. The book is available on Amazon. I have a Facebook page. You know, I'm around should anybody care to get in touch, you know.
And I can't wait to read it. I really am compelled.
I appreciate that. And, you know, it's nice of you to be so interested. And I hope you like it also, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I will. I'll let you know.
Okay, good. Yeah. Write me a scathing review and we can discuss how.
I'm not qualified. I'm not qualified.
Experiment,
but
you know, I'll tell you what feels worse, you know.
Now, before we go, if you like, share a little insight for those listening that are aspiring writers or artists or confused with the state of affairs in our country, whatever you like, maybe a little tidbit, a little insight.
I'm confused with the state of affairs too. Uh-oh, the onus is on me now. No, I think in terms of writing, every cliche sort of applies. You have to sit down and write. And then people have said that a million times, but it really is true. There's no waiting for inspiration to strike. I mean, this stuff sounds like out of a writing primer, but this happens to be true. These are cliches that are accurate. You really have to write, you know? I mean, writing doesn't come from sitting around thinking of an idea. It comes from writing, and what's a quote from Beckett, fail again, fail better. You know, I mean, this all sounds trite, but it really is true, you know? And I think that it's often not possible for those of us to set up 2 hours of unfettered writing every morning. I mean, there's something, you know, that's if you have no obligations whatsoever. So it's hard. It's hard with family. It's hard with work. You have to set out a time to write, and you have to write over and over again. And that's pretty much it. You know, that's it. That's a little, and that's a lot also too, you know, but it's sitting down and putting in the sweat, you know, which again sounds sort of like tough love in a way, but this happens to be true. You know, if you want to write, you know, how's that for a profundity?
I love it.
Yeah. I think that's the only way, you know, and the rest is all strategy, trying to get published, that sort of thing. I mean, that's a whole other issue. But if you want to create, you sit down and create, you know. If there's no time in the morning, do it at night. If there's no time during the day, do it during your lunch break. It's hard. It's very, very hard. But do it, you know. Just do it.
Nike. No.
Exactly.
Richard Klein, it's a pleasure talking with you. You have a wonderful energy, and I look forward to seeing what you do in the future and checking out some of the stuff you've done in the past. I'm going on the web as soon as we get off the phone.
Well, thank you. I've loved being on the podcast. I've loved listening to it, and I'm flattered to be included. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care of yourself.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Glad Rags. One of the last times I saw my mother, she was in the hospital for her final stay, propped up on her bed, and she reached over and touched the short sleeve of my button-down summer shirt. "Did I buy you this?" she asked. She asked that question about every shirt I wore, or rather about every shirt I wore that she liked, that she thought was classy, snazzy, smart. By this late period in our lives, she was no longer supplying much, if any, of my clothing. So in this case, the correct answer would be no. But I said yes. And she was satisfied with the answer, momentarily forgetting that she was dying and focusing on more important matters, like the nice plaid shirt she bought for her son. Over the years, she bought me many shirts, plaid, striped, solid, and pants, bootlegged and bell-bottomed, and windbreakers and dress coats and peacoats and sweaters and ties, and a few hats. A late acquisition still has pride of place in my winter wardrobe. It's a black, cable-knit, 100% acrylic, basic edition sweater. I didn't really need it at the time, but I was on a visit, and my mother wanted to buy me something, partly as a sign of her independence, but mainly for the joy in buying me clothes. She was living on Social Security, on a severely limited budget, in a small, subsidized senior citizen apartment, so that acrylic sweater represented a portion of her monthly budget. Now and then she would assert her prerogative as a mother, and the bulky sweater was the result. It was so hefty that it stretched my cheap suitcase to its limit and weighed me down as I hauled it through the airport. The sweater was hot, hard to fit under a coat, and a tad scratchy. It was, however, indestructible, and many years later, it's still doing cold-weather duty. My mother had been buying me clothes since I was born, beginning, I suppose, with the jumper I'm wearing in my one baby picture. There's a 5 or 6 year gap in my childhood photos, which I've always attributed to the pall my father's death cast when I was 8 months old, but I'm not sure if that's the reason. From childhood through high school and with occasional purchases to the end of her life, my mother was my haberdasher. She loved buying me clothes just as much as she relished criticizing the clothes I bought on my own. "You're not wearing that," she might ask, eyeing a pair of striped jeans that made me look like a sailor in an MGM musical, or warning me of the beatings coming my way if I wore the beret I bought through an ad in the back of Harper's Magazine. She decked me out with suits, like my black First Holy Communion number. She bought that at Samter's, a somewhat snooty store, at least from our working-class south side of town perspective. That store had a tailor, a consummate professional who treated all his customers, young or old, large or small, rich or poor, as if he were the Duke of Windsor stopping off in our coal town for a quick fitting. My next suit was picked up off the rack at Robert Hall, and my last suit for my high school photo, and the last suit I ever bought, as it happens, at the downtown department store where she worked as a floater, moving from department to department and taking advantage of her employee discount when she could. She bought my official garb, my Boy Scout uniform, which didn't get much use since I left the organization at the rank of tenderfoot, and my altar boy vestments, which later became the symbol of my apostasy. "Remember when you were an altar boy?" my mother would ask wistfully. She didn't have to worry about sports uniforms. At my prodding and pleading, she made a series of unfortunate purchases as fashions changed with the times and my whims and shifting self-image and constant movie-going. A powder blue dickie, cowboy boots that proved so uncomfortable I wore them once or twice and shoved them under my bed, hoping that she would forget. She didn't. A faux leather leisure suit jacket. A frilly pirate shirt. Somehow we never scored a Nehru jacket. As I aged and then moved away, her purchases became less frequent, except for gifts and shirts bought on visits. My mother was something of a clothes horse herself. Her favorite store was in our neighborhood, a few blocks from our house, and the woman who owned it was named Peggy Barrett. Her name became a shorthand for fine clothes. She made trips to New York City to acquire the skirts and blouses and jackets that filled her store and my mother's closet. It was my mother's coal town version of couture. In her final illness, we knew that she was giving up on life when she no longer cared about her hair and her clothes. The last time I saw my mother, she could no longer speak. so she couldn't ask me if she bought the summer shirt I was wearing. But of course, the answer would be yes. Yes, you did, Mom.
Mamma, solo per te la mia canzone vola. Mamma, sarai con me, tu non sarai più sola. Quanto ti voglio bene, queste parole d'amore che ti sospira il mio cuore, forse non s'usano. E per la vita non ti lascio mai più. Mamma, I miss the days when you were near to guide me. Mamma, those happy days when you were here beside me, safe in the glow of your love, sent from the heavens above. Nothing can ever replace the warmth of your tender per la vita non ti lascio mai più. Mamma.
Struggle, a.k.a. Gladys. Old Satchmo knew how to live in his time. And today, how much of it all has changed? The reason, the rhyme. Has it been rearranged as mine? It is all so warm and strange, this struggle in my bubble. As the carpenter bees do their spring dance, eating at my outside apparatus, they, in groups of three or four, float just outside my door. One of them, I think, answers to the name Gladys. What more can I do?
Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged and funny, but we'll travel along, singing a song.
Here a little bit. through all kinds of weather. What if the sky should fall? Just as long as we're together, it doesn't matter at all.
When they've all had the quarrels and parted, we'll be the same as we started, just a traveling along, singing a song, side by side.
Look, you know, this, that wasn't too much of a job for me. I wasn't very large at all.
Well, sir, your style doesn't make us quite tingle.
Were you expecting maybe Elvis or Bingo?
For right or for wrong, we'll string along side by side.
Once my style was considered exquisite.
We're only asking, what is
stabbed
it?
Stabbed by my own flesh and blood.
Song, we'll string along side by side.
Now look here. I recall a time when the fans thought that I had class.
Leave us not, go back to the Pilgrims and Plymouth Mass.
You have given my pride a few blisters. Next time we get the Maguire sisters.
It was only a rip.
I should have stomped on your crib.
Side by side.
Girls, it was splendid.
Great.
And there you have it, episode 272 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, writer Richard Klin. Check out his new novel, Petroleum Transfer Engineer. Thank you to our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese. And these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, The Beastie Boys, Madeline Peru, Elvis Costello, Jerry Vale, Frank Sinatra and the Maguire Sisters, Terrence Blanchard and Branford Marsalis II. Until next week, how about we enjoy this one? Thanks for listening.